That takes us to 8:34 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert, staying local in the final segment of our program. Tonight's meeting of the Oakland City Council could see a massive redevelopment battle come to a head. At stake, the future of the Kaiser Convention Center, the beautiful Beaux-Arts building next to Late Merritt and the Oakland Museum. In its heyday, the arena on that site hosted performances by Elvis Presley, Tina Turner, 57 concerts by the Grateful Dead. Martin Luther King Jr. gave a speech there on the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. Ralph Nader held a super rally there during his 2000 presidential campaign. But for the past 13 years, the building has been empty, shut down, fenced off. Now, the city of Oakland built that building. It owns that building. And now it's considering a plan to hand off control of that building to a private developer who will carry out a $50 million overhaul and turn much of what's inside into offices and workshop space that it says will largely benefit local arts organizations. Problem is, many of those arts organizations aren't convinced they'll actually benefit. And a coalition including the Black Arts Movement Business District and the Eastside Arts Alliance and the Malunga Arts Residents Association are now appealing the pieces of that plan that have already been approved by the city's planning commission. We're joined in studio by the person heading up that coalition, poet, playwright, director, and Hellraiser, Ayodele Nzinga. Thank you so much for coming in.
You are so welcome. Thank you for an opportunity to speak to community about this extremely important matter.
I have this visual of your desk right now, and on the left side is a binder with a play script on it, and on the right side is like a staff 5 feet deep of planning documents.
You are describing my desk. I don't know how you can see that.
There's not too many people who can live with their head in both worlds. How are you doing it?
It's not easy, but it's necessary. And sometimes when you're getting pushed around, you have to push back. And so this is a crucial time in Oakland. We've been in a trend that's been going on for quite some while. And as an effect of that trend, development is pushing out long-time established Oaklanders. They're being priced out. And in the latest statistics show that the income gap between people of color and their counterparts in Oakland is steadily growing. Oakland's done a lot of thinking about equity and how we got here. Now, I have some ideas. It's the privatization of things. It's the selling of parking lots and building high-rises at market rate rather than building affordable housing, and the national trend where the public sphere is being privatized. So we come down to the Henry J. Kaiser site. That is the last large piece of public land that has the history that that space has as a performance and a civic gathering space. And the current proposal is about to turn a piece of public land that once served thousands into largely market-rate office space that will serve hundreds. And I question who those hundreds are. I don't think it's being built for people who currently live in Oakland.
So we tried to invite the developer who's trying to get into this redevelopment agreement with the city onto the program. They declined. Their name is Orton. So I'm going to try to paraphrase their pitch to the best of my ability and invite your responses. I understand their pitch. It is this. The building is crumbling. Oakland, although it owns it, does not have the money to fix it up. And so Orton's plan is something that will pay for itself and in the process create a little bit of subsidized art space in the city. And basically they're saying the portions that are market rate have to be market rate to make the whole thing pencil out. Like what are your specific, do you have specific problems with what they're proposing, or is that there's too many unanswered questions about how the details will work out?
Specific problems and too many questions, and a question for the city. if you're concerned about bleeding people of color and small arts organizations, when are you going to enact the equity mandates you've developed around mitigating displacement? The question for me is, as a site, private or city, is it going to benefit community? And if the pitch is that merely restoring the site is a community benefit, I think that that's terribly short-sighted. The city, in some parts, seems enamored with this project because it exists and the building's been vacant for a long time. Our city often acts from a space of scarcity, like we have to make a deal with this developer or no other developers will come. That's what they were telling me back in 2016 when I decided if I didn't fight, I wouldn't be able to stay in Oakland. And I've seen a steady stream of developers since 2016, so that logic doesn't seem to hold. Billions of dollars have come through Oakland since 2016. At this point in time, perhaps someone else might want to take that property and have a more community-centered view. In short, the city's own policy says that it should use existing public land, and it so deeply states this policy, it even goes on to say if it doesn't have the public land, that it should purchase it for the explicit purpose of creating equitable outcomes for communities that have been made fragile through historic racism. So this is a public site on which they could do that. Now, as you stated in Orton's statement, the city claims it has no money to do so. So if you have no money to purchase anything else and you own this and you don't leverage it to stop displacement, then aren't you allowing displacement to continue? There's a term for that. When they look back in hindsight, they'll call this a period of benign neglect. Death by benign neglect is still dead. In many ways, Orton got this contract. In many ways, the fault lies with the city. Orton got this contract in early 2015. The downtown Oakland specific plan was a point in time in Oakland history when it was actually forced by community to begin to look at specific plans through an equity lens. The city is commissioned and benefited from the results of a number of studies that show most artists in Oakland have lost a workspace or had to move from their home. Black artists are misplaced at a faster rate than their counterparts. And the amount of color flowing out of this town is measurable. So if you look at a situation and you say that this certain set of circumstances has created it, and in order to mitigate it, we must do these things. When you use words like crises and emergency, then one would expect expedient action. So even though Orton got the contract in 2015, all of this thought around equity has developed since then. Why at no point did our city not tell Orton the city is changing? We've identified some problems we have to address. If your project is to be for arts and nonprofits, maybe it ought to be more than 17%. Maybe we have a greater need. As an artist, I don't necessarily need another co-working space to be available for me. I need venue space. I need production space. When we look at comparable venues, the Paramount is hopelessly compromised. No one in Oakland can afford to produce in the Paramount. It usually hosts traveling shows. Mm-hmm. The Fox was supposed to be for the people. The city took in an enormous amount of input. I give them credit for even utilizing some of the ideas that community offered. But the pricing structure is such that it cost, I think, Eastside Arts Alliance paid in the neighborhood of $40,000 to produce a benefit that was a few hours long.
A one-night engagement.
Yes. And there are only, I believe, 7 such days available to community all year. So I'll submit that's not accessible. The use of the space is affected by a lot of things. I'm interested in what the merit of building out these temporary structures that create then a market rate sort of hub with artist space confined to the basement, and the rates that they're offering for it, we're still in the process of trying to see how they think that's affordable. Mm-hmm.
Spell it out from your, so, you know, when you're not wearing your, like, city politics hat, you're producing plays through the lower bottom players,
mm-hmm.
Trying to scrape together spaces for rehearsal, spaces to stage productions. What they were talking about, KQED had a big write-up on this back and forth over the weekend, and the figure they kind of threw out was $2 a square foot for office and workshop space. Is that a price at which it would be accessible to you doing your work?
No. No.
Who would it be accessible to?
I think that we have the SOBs, the symphony, the orchestra, and the ballet
mm-hmm.
might find that space affordable in the present moment. Certainly it's a beautiful facility. I could hear Michael Morgan mm-hmm. in that place. The problem is with the operational model that's proposed, and from the experience of being in arts collectives and running art space, what we can see on paper doesn't seem sustainable. And so if it's not sustainable to solve a problem in the short run, and then for that not to be able to sustain would actually hurt those organizations more than it would help them. It's terribly short-sighted of anyone who's feeling a crunch of production here in Oakland not to think about our arts ecosystem holistically. The race they're proposing, actually, I mean, there was an incident. A nonprofit out in East Oakland called me and was curious about what the appeal was, and they had been pitched by Orton, and they were open to a conversation because they were being priced out of their space.
Mm-hmm.
The proposed prices that were pitched to them were the exact price that was pricing them out of the space that they were currently in. Again, it may not be all the developers' fault. In many ways, the city has been extremely welcoming of this process. They've been in this process since 2015. We have questions about city process. At what point is a development recast so many times until it's actually a new project and should perhaps trigger a new bid? I can't seem to find that threshold in our city. The city's communication policy with community is raggedy and needs attention. Planning, the body that we appeal, is actually scheduled, I believe, 3 to 4 meetings to talk about their problems with community engagement. They don't even seem to be able to have that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Racial disparity exists even in the way they interact with community. If you only notice developments to property owners, then that leaves out everybody that's a tenant. Aren't they community members as well? Aren't the impacts of development just as crucial to them as they are to people who own property? In many ways, our city seems extremely pro-developer. And I suppose that cities get to take their own stances about things like that. But in my thought, the city works for us as well. And so not to give us a fair chance to engage with developers early in the process so that we can do what the city recommends doing going forward, which is look for ways to leverage and create equitable outcomes for fragile communities. And I'm not just pulling this, you know, somewhere out of my visionary heart. These are actual pieces of city policy. This city has a Department of Race and Equity that has municipal code that codified it in 2016. Mm-hmm. Why do we have all of the language if we're never going to enact it? Why do we have the language if it doesn't have any teeth? I suspect that when people write policy, if they're clever enough to write it, then I suspect that they're clever enough to be very cognizant as to whether or not they are giving it teeth. So it's a complex situation that's fed by the city's own either lack of desire or inability to act intersectionally, where departments talk to one another and that the city as a whole can achieve goals it sets for itself. As a community member, I worry about things like when you collect impact fees to build affordable housing and you've been doing this 3 or 4 years and not a single unit has been built. And so for all of those worried about one more rent increase, they better be able to pay whatever it is for the next 6, 7 years. That's how long it takes between an accepted plan, shovels in the ground, and keys in the door. So again, we get back to benign neglect. If you know you were bleeding color and people beneath a certain income level, and you actually study that, and you develop strategy to address it, and you fail to enact that strategy, doesn't that suggest that you're perfectly happy with what's going on? And it's not that we're anti-development. Growth and change are good. But in many ways, we've been looking for change for decades that doesn't come until the balance of a neighborhood shifts, thus prompting the question for us, who are you building for? Mm-hmm. It's the imagine with me for a moment the concept of having a 30-year plus arts practice in a place where you've gone through the bad times and you held on sometimes just because really you wanted to be of service right there, and that's where your vision was, and you developed a community that you served, and then that's disrupted. For me, if I'm forced to move to Fresno or Antioch, Oakland's oldest black theater company dies. I don't have that amount of time left in my life to establish a relationship with another community. Do I go to Antioch and then infuse myself in the problems and the joys of Antioch? I'm an outsider, and I'll be an outsider for a while. The average refugee, when we think of refugee in the way that the word is usually used, statistics show that it takes those families approximately 30 years to put their lives back together, to belong where they are. So these disruptions are not just, oh, well, you know, you ended up in another city. We're a mobile population now. People's lives being disrupted for 30 years, how does that affect their ability to affect change where they are, to even have a voice of any kind where they are? So when you disrupt communities and then disperse the populations, you also disperse their ability to stand up for themselves, to support each other. So in many ways, we filed the appeal because we had to. We're fighting for our lives.
It's the voice of Iodelia Nzinga, poet, playwright, director with the Lower Bottom Players, and in her capacity as the head of the Black Arts Movement Business District in Oakland. She's heading the coalition of community arts groups that are appealing the current redevelopment proposal as approved by the Oakland Planning Commission for the Henry J. Kaiser Auditorium, formerly the Oakland Civic Auditorium. And I'll mention again, we did invite the developer, Orton, to come on. When we put in the request, they said they were in last-minute talks. They were hoping to work out a community benefits agreement that would settle the concerns that you have raised. I don't suppose you can tell us anything about how those talks are going.
They're in the early stages, and to be honest, we have asked him to totally rethink the frame that he's operating in. We've asked him to provide information that we think that we should have been able to vet a long time ago. We're kind of frustrated with the fact that a project could be at this point and there could still be so many questions. We have been in talks. The appeal is currently scheduled for tonight. If the developer can come to an understanding of what equity in Oakland means to us and the city's responsibility to enact its own policy at this point in time, perhaps then the developer can change how he's approaching the project and help to create situations which aren't just equitable in the moment, that could be equitable, create a shift in equity for the over the time in which he has the space. It has to be something significant if we as community are going to have to accept his control of a public space for the next century. And in many ways, not fighting for me. This man is going to be in relationship with this city when my grandchildren are scrapping about things. And so
the city's considering a 99-year lease.
A 99-year lease.
Yeah.
Which is rather unheard of. And some people are speculating over whether or not it's actually legal.
Yeah. Adelia, we've only got like a minute left. So I want to like ask you for a second to take the process up to this point off the board, start from scratch, and I'll put a magic wand in your hand. What would you want to see happen to that building and that land?
I would love to see that historic building, first of all, not be built upon by temporary things. I'd actually like to see community in the process of this find a mechanism that allows them to have equity in the historic portion of that. I would like for community to actually be able to buy in. I think that that's what's necessary for poor and marginalized people at this point in time not to have these conversations. Mm. I would like to create a situation where the community never has to have another conversation about the Calvin Simmons and the Henry J. Kaiser because they're the majority equity holders in it. And see, that's the kind of thing that this developer needs to be willing to consider in order for us to agree to be in relationship with him for 100 years.
Iodelian Zynga, thank you so much for coming in this morning.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you.
Iodelian Zynga is a poet, playwright, director, and now Hellraiser. She heads the Black Arts Movement Business District in Oakland. She's also heading the coalition that is appealing the pieces of the Kaiser Center redevelopment plan that have already been approved by Oakland's Planning Commission. That appeal is going to Oakland City Council at tonight's meeting. And that does it for today's show. If you want to get in touch, send us an email at upfront@kpfa.org. A big thanks to Corinne Smith, Kirsten Thomas, Kat Brooks, who's on vacation, Janine Etter, who's going to be in with me tomorrow, to our interns Justin Gold, Casey Repke, and Elizabeth Soul, and also to Mitch Jezerich and Eileen Alfandary. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Stay up and stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming your way in 2 minutes at 9 o'clock.